Kettner. In the second half of today's show, we're going to be speaking with the keynote speaker at next week's Better Buildings by Design conference. If you're interested in finding out more about the conference, go to the Efficiency Vermont website. That's www.efficiencyvermont.com. You can find out how to sign up for it. It's going to be Wednesday and Thursday of next week. The numbers here, if you want to join us, are 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Our guest is Fernando Pajes, and he is a home builder, a developer, and an author. He speaks internationally on how to build high-quality, affordable, and energy-efficient homes. He's got 30 years of experience as a builder. He knows how to cut costs and maintain quality. His two books are, one, Building an Affordable House, a high-value, low-cost approach to building, and two, Affordable Remodel, how to get custom results on any budget. He's also a regular contributor to Fine Home Building and the Journal of Light Construction. He's a president of Brighton Construction in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in Sheridan, Wyoming. He's been featured in New York Times, Dwell, Better Homes and Gardens, National Public Radio, and other national media. And he is somewhere traveling, and we've been on and off the phone with him. And we seem to be off the phone with him right now and are very close to bringing him up, it looks like. And I think we have Fernando on the line. Is that you?
Yes, you do.
Fernando.
Hi, Carl.
Hello. Welcome to Equal Time.
Well, thank you.
As our fearless engineers were there getting you on the line, then I was just giving the introduction, a little bit of your background. So if you don't mind, let's jump right into, and you weren't on the line listening, so you can't deny anything I said. I'm afraid I don't, not giving you a chance to correct me where I made any mistakes.
But I'm sure you did fine.
Could we jump into the subject of your keynote address at next week's Better Buildings by Design conference, high-quality, low-cost, green-built homes? I mean, these three adjectives sound like something where a builder would say high-quality, low-cost, green-built, pick any two, but you say all three of them can go together. How's that?
Well, I think all three of them have to go together. First of all, one of the definitions of energy-efficient construction and green building in general is, in fact, high-quality construction. If all you are is a very, very good builder, you've probably accomplished at least 80 to 90% of what it takes to do an energy-efficient building.
So, for example, you build it tight so there aren't leaks in it.
You build it tight so there aren't leaks in it. You size the equipment correctly so that it works, the heating and air conditioning equipment, so that it works in relationship to the size of the house, to its orientation in terms of the sun, to its location. You engineer the plumbing system so they work adequately for the loads, so that you're not either, you know, oversizing or undersizing your pipes and your equipment. You optimized all of your plumbing runs so that you maybe centralized the water heater and the location where the water meter comes in, so that you have very short pipe runs. This makes it a lot more efficient to build, more cost effective, and also delivers hot water more quickly.
Mm. And you don't spend too much on the foundation, so you can spend more on what's above it.
Well, this is, again, another area where all of this coincides. You can, there's two things we're talking about. One of them is energy efficiency, and this is a huge component of green building. And by green building, I just mean construction that is energy efficient for sure, in terms of good stewardship of our natural resources, but also includes what kind of materials you use in the construction of a home, and how much you use. That's a big, that's a big portion of conservation, is just how much material you use. And, well, one thing you can do is you can design your house. And remember, this is the name of the conference, Better Buildings by Design. You can design your building so it has a much smaller footprint. In other words, it has a much smaller foundation. And then when you build that foundation, you can use materials, again, that reduce the amount of concrete, the amount of how deeply you have to dig footings, how much you have to disturb the soil. In other words, minimizes the use of materials and the impact that that building has on the ground on which it sits.
Mm. Yeah, speaking of footprint, there's an architect out of Minnesota who's built a whole little mini industry out of the not-so-big house concept of designing houses that are smaller than average and work very well for people. And she says that her clients are much more satisfied in them than they are in buildings that are twice as big. And as you point out, they're much greener because they're using a lot less material.
Yes, the idea is that you can do something of higher quality and lower quantity, a little bit like the French restaurant, right? Very, very good food, small portions. The side effect is that you don't gain as much weight, right? It's better for you. But the problem with the French restaurant approach is it's also very expensive. And these are little jewel boxes of houses that you're talking about. What I'm doing is a little bit different. I'm talking about really low-cost housing.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Suzanka, that architect in Minnesota, she's into making them into jewel boxes. That's a good term for it because she wants people to spend a lot of money they'd otherwise spend on space, on interior detailing. But you're interested in just making simple houses that work for people. And how do you do that on a large scale?
Well, it's a little bit easier to do on a large scale because, of course, you have the economy of volume. You can buy things and get a little bit better price by buying in bulk. But the basic approach has to do with value engineering. Value engineering is just a method in which you look for the lowest cost method to achieve the desired ends. So, for example, if you're looking for energy efficiency in a house, then you apply the lowest cost methods that will achieve it. So if, for example, fiberglass insulation will work and achieve the ratings and the kind of energy conservation that you want, then that's what you use. You may forego using a more expensive product like a foam insulation. That's a great product. It's an excellent product, but it costs three times as much. Mm-hmm. So if a good, well-aimed caulking gun and a tube of sealant along with some fiberglass insulation placed in a very workmanlike way will achieve the ends, and that's what you do. Mm-hmm. So now you've really super insulated your house, but using the least expensive materials rather than the most.
When you start out asking the question, I want energy efficiency, how can I get it most inexpensively, then does that pretty much automatically lead you to other questions of siting and building orientation so you take best advantage of the sun?
Well, yes, it can if you have that freedom. Most of the work that I do is done in inner-city redevelopment projects, and the lots are defined. You know, they're right along the street, and whatever street we happen to be on, then that's the side that the that front of the house is going to face. Yeah. So if you have the choice, if you have a large enough lot, then absolutely you should do that. Most of the time you don't. And so what you have to do is you have to try and take advantage of the site in terms of where do you put your larger windows. You might have a decision on how to face your roof, you know, whether to do it perpendicular to the street, the classic, you know, gable end, or to turn it the other way. Mm. And so there are still decisions you can make in terms of, you know, just what would be the best, what would optimize the solar gain or not, depending on your climate, and you know which it would, do you have the long face of the house facing the wind? Is your long face going to be east and west, getting most of the summer sun gain, or is it north and south? So this even with a city lot, you can make a lot of decisions in terms of how to site the house for optimum energy efficiency and also for comfort and sheer pleasure of having the sun shine in at the right time of day.
And when you build houses, we were just talking before you came on with Michael Olson. He's the host of the Food Chain Radio. He's written a book about putting very small farms and very small pieces of land in the city called Metro Farm. And when you design houses, do you look at lots in terms of places for landscape, for gardens as well?
Well, not exactly in the same vein, but I have an interesting story about this. One of the things I discovered in doing inner-city redevelopment projects is, of course, that different ethnic and cultural groups have different architectural preferences. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really frustrated in a Vietnamese community that I was working in, that really frustrated the people there, was that the covenants required them to have their yards and any kind of gardening that they did in the backyard. And mm-hmm. what they really enjoyed was to have their plants, you know, their vegetables in the front yard. So we designed a subdivision in which the covenants allowed you to have gardening in the front of the house. And what was interesting about having a, you know, tomato garden or a few herbs in the front of the house is that you're always seeing it as you come and go to your house. And so you have a tendency to really take care of it. You have, you know, you're reminded of it all the time. Whereas if you stick that tomato garden in the back corner of the back of your lot, that's where it tends to be, like, you know, good intentions in the spring that by summer have been completely forgotten, and it's just kind of a nasty looking dried up patch of vegetables.
It's got to be a good community building principle too to have those out front, because you're out there weeding and planting and so on, and people are walking by and you have a chance to have conversations, like sitting on a rocking chair on your front porch.
Sure. This requires probably what is fundamental to a better stewardship of our resources and natural energy, the change that is most difficult, which is a social change. Many people regard that tomato patch in the front yard as ugly. You know, you're supposed to have a pristine green lawn with a few shrubs and some perennials out there. But to me, that tomato garden is beautiful. Mm. And that old grandmother tending to the vegetable garden is a beautiful sight. It's, to me, much more attractive than a green lawn. However, covenants and neighborhood groups and all often oppose this sort of thing. Same thing with our zoning regulations. One of the worst offenders in terms of environmental stewardship and good energy efficiency and resource management is the zoning boards that require us to live in these vast dormitories separate from all of the businesses and the commercial uses that we need to then commute to with our cars, rather than have them in close proximity. The fact that we have to spread the lots way out, right, because we don't like density, when in fact density is one of the best things you can do environmentally, because you limit the impact, again, of this group of people living in close proximity, rather than spread out with acres and acres of land around each house and roads and all of that. We no longer live on the prairie. We're no longer settlers, you know, out in the westward expansion. We're not a few hundred thousand. We're now millions upon millions, and we need to, consolidate so we don't have such a vast impact on where we're living. Mm.
There's a movement afoot out here to build co-housing eco-villages, where they address that by taking a rather large plot of land and clustering all the houses together, so that if you average everything together, it meets the zoning regulations. But they're really much tighter than the zoning regulations envisioned, and you leave all this other land untouched, which is good for that land, I guess. It does leave all the houses just as far from the city center, where most of these are out in the countryside, as if they'd been put on single family lots. So there's still a lot of transportation involved there.
Yes, and it's one of the best changes in terms of zoning. It's unfortunately too difficult to achieve. You have to struggle quite a bit to create a subdivision like this. But it has several advantages, one of which is, of course, the consolidation of all of the utilities into a smaller area. It's less costly to do this. It also allows that group of houses to take advantage of alternative energy sources in a very practical and cost-effective way, which is essentially to create a kind of nonprofit utility company that can do things like put up photovoltaic arrays or windmill power generators, ground source heat pump loops. On that land, you can use that much more effectively than you can on a single house that's trying to create its own energy and use ground heat and those kinds of things all by itself. It's just too costly. The initial cost, it just will never happen. Very, very few people are willing to invest that kind of money on a house that they may not even occupy for 10 years. Even if the building itself has a 100-year life cycle, and it'll be paid back many, many, many times fold, it's just like the power grid. None of us individually have the money to to create the power grid or the road system or anything. It has to be spread out. And this is one opportunity to create small, little utilities for a particular homeowners association group to use.
We're talking with Fernando Pajes. He is a keynote speaker next week at the Better Buildings by Design Conference, a home builder, developer, and author of a couple books on building and remodeling. If you'd like to join the conversation, 244-1777, or call us on the toll-free line, 877-291-8255. Well, speaking of how no individual bears the cost of the power grid, there is a law that's working its way through the Vermont legislature. I don't know whether it's been introduced, but if it hasn't been, it will soon be introduced, to allow municipalities to bond to raise money for homeowners to use in energy efficiency improvements or in renewable energy like solar panels, things that generally have a longer payback time than a lot of bank loans that you can get, and the bonding would be at a lower rate of interest too, as well, and the loan would travel with the property, not with the homeowner. So if I wanted to put solar panels on my house and I thought, well, maybe I'm going to sell it in 3 years, I would know that that loan would travel with the property of the house. I would not be burdened with it at the time that I left the house, or have to bake it into the selling price of the house, which is going down in most markets right now. Does that strike you as a sort of sound policy to get more high-quality, low-cost, green-built homes?
It sounds like a brilliant policy. Vermont is leading the nation. I don't think I'm just saying this to be complimentary. I think it's actually true in terms of its energy policy with regards to houses. And I think there's a movement afoot in Vermont to try and reduce energy consumption by 15%. There's a lot of these kinds of very, very creative solutions. I think this one is a particularly good one, because the biggest obstacle is first cost. And anything that'll solve the financing and spread it out over more time or more people is the way to go.
Well, I do have to confess that Burlington was looking at this in advance of the rest of Vermont, but a little community in California called Berkeley got to it, to implementing it before Burlington did. But we're almost leading the nation. We'll be the first state that has this law if it gets passed here.
State, I think that you are. And there are communities in different states that are very progressive. The most progressive green code, building code now in the nation, I think, is in Boulder, Colorado. But as a state, I think Vermont is leading the nation.
Interesting. Well, I was interested, Fernando Pajes, to learn that you do a lot of your work in urban redevelopment. And from what I've seen, the amount of energy that people spend on transportation to and from their homes is so great that in an urban area, you can do almost anything by design, and it's going to be greener than a green-built home out in the countryside. Is that your experience as well?
Yes. Unfortunately, our culture has an ethic of broad space and lots of room and room to breathe, elbow room, all those kinds of things. This is not a universal view. People in other cultures and immigrants often like to live in highly dense, very social environments. We are, after all, a social animal. And when we travel places, when we go and we spend money to go visit some other city that we really enjoy, we tend to go to places like Europe, very dense urban areas. We don't tend to go to the suburbs, right? There aren't too many hotels where people go and spend their vacations looking at vast suburban tracts.
I spent part of my honeymoon there, but that was an accident.
What was that?
I spent part of my honeymoon in a suburb, but that was an accident.
Oh. Well, most of us spend all of our lives in the suburbs. And,
right.
And it's an unfortunate accident because, you're right, an urban setting not only has, the environmental benefits of having concentrated utilities, the expenses of, supplying people with electricity and gas and water, et cetera, into a smaller space, but also it has the creative advantage of all of that interaction between people. That's where you come up with the great cultural developments and the great restaurants and all of those things. I should, if you don't mind me steering a little bit.
Go ahead.
I'd really like to talk a little bit about how to make an effective, low-cost, energy-efficient, very green-built home.
Because my background
has been in constructing low-cost housing. And my first challenges when we first started doing this was simply to try to reduce the cost so that we could get a very nice, aesthetically pleasing house with a few amenities that could compete really at the very, very, very bottom of the price range, whatever neighborhood we were building in. And coincidentally, and this was something I discovered after the fact, and then I began working with it and taking advantage of it, but this is something I discovered after the fact. A lot of what you do to reduce costs also improves the energy efficiency of a house and reduces, of course, the materials that you use to construct it. Can I give you an example?
Please do. We've got about 3 minutes left here.
Okay, here's an example. Take a square, and this square is 25 foot long on each of its four sides, right?
Yep.
And so you're multiplying this square, and how many square feet? Let's just simpler, 20 by 20, 800 square feet, okay?
Okay.
So you got a 20 by 20, 800 square foot square, little house. That square has, in terms of lineal feet of exterior wall, has 80 lineal feet of exterior wall, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now let's take that same little design and turn it into a rectangle. Okay, so now you have a 40 by 20 foot. Let's see, 40 in one side, 40 10. By
40
20 by
10.
20, 400 square feet, so you got a 10 by 40 rectangle.
Yep.
So you have 400 square feet on that rectangle, right? Mm-hmm. 400 square feet enclosed in the rectangle, 400 square feet enclosed in the square. When you add the sides up of the rectangle, you end up with 100 lineal feet. Two sides at 40, two sides at 10. 40 and 40 is 80, 10 and 10 is 20, 100 lineal feet. 100 lineal feet of exterior wall on this particular shape. Same square footage of living area, but 20 more lineal feet of exterior wall. What does that mean?
That means
you've got to spend the money, an additional 20%, to build those exterior walls. It also means that you have another 20% of the area exposed to the wind and the sun and all of those things that consume energy when heating and cooling a house. So not only have you saved more money by building a square house, 20 by 20, but you've also made it a more energy efficient house. And I would work with little details of the construction, like it's better to build a square house, it's better to build a two-story square house than it is to build a rectangular one, and then discovered that, coincidentally, the same things that were saving me money, which was lower square feet of exterior surface, were also turning out to be more energy efficient because you had 20% less exposure to the elements.
So not only are you saving the money up front, then you're saving the money over the length of the home's life.
Absolutely. Now, you make a decision like that just simply to lower cost. You don't want to add cost like photovoltaics. But let's say that you have $100,000 to build a house, hypothetically. That's in my range. That's the kind of money I spend, very little. And you do want to use photovoltaics and those kinds of things. Well, find then a way to reduce the cost of that house down to $80,000, and you have 20 to invest in those kinds of things that bring long-term return, and maybe in terms of a life cycle analysis of the building, are much lower cost.
Okay.
Standard construction, but initially add a little bit to that cost.
I'm afraid we're out of time there. Fernando Pajes, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fernando Pajes will be the keynote speaker at the Better Buildings by Design conference next week. Go to efficiencyvermont.com to find out more about it. I'm Carl Etnayer. You've been listening to Equal Time. Thanks for tuning in.